Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Good morning to everybody who is physically present, as well as those who are virtually present. And it's wonderful to get back here again and learn some Torah together. We are looking at one of the great personalities of the 19th century, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, and the impact that he has had on Jewish life ever since. We have sponsorship for this year of Shiurim for Refuah Shleima of Janet Bat Chana. She should have a Refuah Shleima, and a thank you appreciation to the anonymous sponsor. Actually, somebody was just speaking to me now about Sfiras HaOmer, and there are slight different variations in the way we do the Sfiras HaOmer. One of them is that before making the bracha and counting the day, there are some people who say L'shem Yichud Kudsho Barichu, a little tefillah, which is prefixed by the word L'shem Yichud Kudsho Barichu. And actually, this tefillah seems to be relatively interesting and innocent in one way or another, but was actually a subject of a very, very heated debate among Rabbonim a couple of hundred years ago. And in actual fact, it symbolizes a very fascinating distinction educationally and philosophically between different groups of members of the Orthodox Jewish world. What do I mean by that? Is as follows. The L'shem Yichud Kudsho Barichu actually has its origins in the writings of the Mekubalim, in the Kabbalistic writings of the 18th and 19th century. They invented this formula of L'shem Yichud Kudsho Barichu, that Yichud Kudsho Barichu is a Kabbalistic idea of unifying the name of God, and that it bases itself on the Kabbalistic principle that our mitzvot, when we do mitzvot, we are having a cosmic effect on the Olam HaElyon. There is an Olam HaElyon, there are higher worlds beyond this world, which are happening and are powerful at the same time as this world, as the world that we are familiar with. And by doing mitzvot, we are able to be miyached kudsho barichu, meaning in some way to unite the various different, so to speak, broken parts of the universe. There is what's called the idea of tikkun ha'olam. Now, we're familiar with the word tikkun ha'olam in its more modern usage, which in a sense has been hijacked often by the non-Orthodox world. When they say the word tikkun ha'olam, they mean social justice. You know, you go to Africa and help the starving children in Africa, and they call that tikkun haolam. And it's not really tikkun haolam, it's chesed. That's fine, chesed is good. The word tikkun haolam is a Kabbalistic word, which means that the universe, the cosmos, the higher worlds had in some way been smashed, had been negatively affected, and by the performance of mitzvot, we can be letaken olam b'malchut shaddai, in some way reunify the spiritual worlds, the cosmic worlds, and every mitzvah has that effect. And by saying l'shem yichud, could put your mind on the fact that you want your mitzvah to have that cosmic effect. Why it's only done really with Sfiras HaOmer is pro practical level. The printers who printed the Durim found that Sfiras HaOmer was actually just such a number, was just so brief, they wanted to in some way dramatize it in a certain sense and make Sfiras HaOmer something more special. So they brought, but the truth is, the real Mekubalim said L'shem Yichud Kudsho Barichu as the preamble to every mitzvah. Before they put on the talus, they said L'shem Yichud Kudsho Barichu. Before they said Birkas HaMazon, the same L'shem Yichud Kudsho Barichu. Every single mitzvah that they engaged in, they prefaced it with this tefillah of L'shem Yichud Kudsho Barichu. And it was an invention of about 200 years ago, highly praised by all the Mekubalim and the Gedolei HaChassidus. However, so that's all on the good side of it. The negative side of it is that there was, and here we're going to come a bit closer to our topic for today, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, right, who was operating in the Litvisha a Lithuanian yeshiva world of the 19th century, he was operating in a world where he was very, I would say fervently even, against the Kabbalistic view of life. That actually we don't want to learn Kabbalah, we don't want to get involved in Kabbalah for a whole variety of reasons. Mainly, I think, because he felt that we don't understand it, right? That really it's something which is beyond our ken, which is beyond our ability to understand. But more importantly, he felt, I think, that the study of Kabbalah will divert people away from the real challenges of Jewish life, which for him were tikkun hamidot, to get to know yourself and to get to improve yourself and to become a better person through various different ways that we've discussed and I'll continue to discuss today. But it's important to understand that Rishon Salanter shifted the focus of Torah learning in the yeshivas very much away from Kabbalistic studies and Kabbalistic ideas, which actually I want you to appreciate what the chiddush of that was, because the yeshiva world, the world, the Lithuanian world of yeshivas, prided itself on being founded on the writings of the Vilna Gaon. Now, the Vilna Gaon was a master Mekubal, a master Kabbalist, and in fact, most of what the Vilna Gaon wrote were commentaries on the Sifra D'Tzniusa, the Raya Mehevna, the Idra, all the Sefer Yetzira, all the classic Kabbalistic texts. The Vilna Gaon became the world authority on these subjects. And if it's indeed true that the literary yeshiva world was based on the Vilna Gaon and his teachings, surely Kabbalah should be a major part of the syllabus. And yet you can go today into any one of the Lithuanian yeshivas, you can go into Hebron and Mir and Slobodka and Telz and any of the yeshivas, and you won't find any mention of the study of Kabbalah. You won't even find the Kabbalah books in their library. They won't even know what you're talking about if you start speaking about the Kabbalistic principles, because it's just not on their radar at all. What happened? And of course, lots of things happened, but what I want to tell you today is one of the main things that happened was Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter had a mega impact on the way Torah was learnt and taught in Lithuania and in the Lithuanian yeshivas throughout the 19th century. And one of the impacts was to shift away from the more mystical Kabbalistic way of thinking into the more Musa way of thinking, that in actual fact, the spiritual growth of the individual does not come about through understanding aspects of Kabbalistic ideas, but through self-improvement, through understanding oneself better and developing one's personality positively and dealing with any negative personality traits that a person has. The whole enterprise of Musa was for him much more, and in fact, it's brought down in one or two of his biographies that Rabbi Yisrael Salanter said about himself that early on in life, he made already a Kabbalah commitment to keep away from Kabbalah, not to study it, not to teach it, and not to use it in his writings. And as a result of which, a whole new, if you like, focus arose, which was against, in a sense, in many ways, against the founders of the yeshiva world. Not only the Vilna Gaon, but also his prime Talmud, who we'll learn about more maybe in later Shiurim, Reb Chaim of Volozhin, who was the primary Talmud of the Vilna Gaon, who established the Volozhin yeshiva. He wrote famously a sefer called the Nefesh HaChaim. Now, the Nefesh HaChaim is a most amazing, amazing philosophical book, but it's based on Kabbalah. Unless you know the principles of Kabbalah, you don't understand what the book's talking about, because it's all about the cosmic effect of Talmud Torah, the cosmic effect of mitzvahs, and how we affect the olamot ha'elyonim, right? So here you have a very interesting paradox. Both the Vilna Gaon and Reb Chaim Volozhin were clearly deeply connected to Kabbalah, but the yeshiva world in general rejected it completely. And the world that we know today as the yeshiva world is not in the least bit interested in Kabbalah. I mean, I went through 10 years in some of the best yeshivas, literacy yeshivas in the world. Nobody ever mentioned or suggested that one should learn Kabbalah or showed me a book of Kabbalah or on mysticism at all. It was completely off the agenda. Off the agenda, completely. And this became one of the, I think, major impacts that Rabbi Yisrael Salanta had on the yeshiva world. In contrast, of course, very deeply in contrast, to the Hasidic world, right? In the world of the Hasidim, and also, in a sense, the Eidot HaMizrach, right? The Hasidim and the Eidot HaMizrach really took the writings of the Arizal, the writings of the Zohar and the Arizal were central focus of their Jewish life, right? And constantly cited and quoted and revered. And that was very, very much not the case in the yeshiva world. I don't want you to misunderstand me. That's not because the yeshiva world didn't revere the Zohar and the Arizal, etc. They just felt that that's not something for them to deal with. That belongs in a different planet. We're coming up now to Lag BaOmer, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, right? So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Lag BaOmer is a major event in the world, both of the Eidot HaMizrach and the Hasidim. In the yeshiva world, it's a non-event. It's not a day really of the calendar of any particular significance, except that you don't say Tachanun and you can have a haircut. Apart from that, nothing else is going on. Right, in the literacy yeshivas, in the non-Hasidic yeshiva world, Lag BaOmer is, it's a minor holiday to the smallest extent, but the whole excitement about the Zohar shown by Yochai and Miron and all this energy is really derives from a culture which is based on the study and the use of the Zohar shown by Yochai and Kabbalah. In the other worlds, both in the, as I say, Lithuanian world and in the Yekisha world, the world of Rosh Hashanah Rafael Hirsch, these were non-events. It was not something of any significance whatsoever. I mean, you're welcome to make a bonfire if you like, you understand what I mean? But it's not really a day of any great importance. Because this whole dimension of mysticism, Kabbalah and mysticism, was really left out of the syllabus. So this is, I think, one of the areas in which Rabbi Yisrael Salanta had a very formative effect on Jewish life as we know it today, right? Most of the Rabbonim, the non-Hasidic and the non-Eidot HaMizrach Rabbonim who you know have been products of yeshivas, right, which were developed on the basis of the Rabbi Yisrael Salanta's philosophy and the yeshiva world. Have a look at your sheet just for a minute. The sheet today doesn't have Divrei Torah on it, but it gives you a little bit of a taste. You can see here at the top of the page, I've written what I consider to be a very important feature of Yisrael Salanta's life and the Musa movement. I've written the 19th century Musa movement inspired leadership. Now, this is something very interesting to focus on just for a minute. The yeshiva world really inspired scholarship, inspired people to become knowledgeable. But I think everybody understands that scholarship does not necessarily mean leadership, right? If you have a look in the Lahavdil in the non-Jewish world, right, the world of the academics is a world of scholarship. It is rarely a world of leadership. It's rare for academics to become leaders because academics are focusing on ideas and texts and principles and concepts, but in the academic world, rarely is a person's personality developed. At the end of the day, leadership requires personality development. It's something where a person is willing to stand up and take a creative role in society and say, I'm going to build a new institution, I'm going to write a book, I'm going to create a community, I'm going to get out there and make this a better world. That's leadership. But for that, you need to have somebody whose personality has been developed. So one of the things Rabbi Yisrael Salanta saw in the yeshiva world was hundreds or thousands of young men who were developing scholarship. They were becoming Talmidei Chachamim. They were knowing Shas, right? but they weren't developing their personality. They weren't becoming leaders in the Jewish people. And this was one of the most fascinating effects of Yisrael Salanta. I'd like you to just have a look with me for a moment at some of what I've written here on this sheet. So you can see here, I've written here, the Kovno Kolel Perushim was founded in 1877 by Rabbi Salanta, headed by Rabbi Yitzchok Blaser, chief rabbi of St. Petersburg, which was at the time the capital of Russia. St. Petersburg later on was renamed as Leningrad and Stalingrad, and it was renamed lots of different by the communists, but that was the capital of the country. And he edited and published the Or Yisrael, which were all the writings of Rabbi Salanta. So he was really one of his major disciples, Rabbi Yitzchok Blaser. And he certainly became somebody who was into leadership training. This Kovno Kolel, right? This Kolel in the town of Kovno. Kovno, of course, was a suburb, was connected to Slobodka. And this was one of the centers of Lithuanian Jewry. And in it, many of the leaders of the next generation were created. So have a look here, Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel. Now, some of you might have known the Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel who passed away only a few years ago, who was the Rosh Hashiva of Mir, right? But he was descended from and named after the original Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, right? Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, who passed away in 1927, he was known as the Altar of Slobodka, which is a name some people might have heard of, because that phrase became like a key phrase in many of the development of many of the yeshivas. Have a look at this, the founder of the Slobodka yeshiva, the Chevron yeshiva, and the Mir yeshiva, right? So you can see already that Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel took the energy that he got from Yisrael Salanta, which he had absorbed in the Kovno Kolel, and he proceeded to build yeshivot and to inspire generations of Talmidei Chachamim and of leaders. So I've written here the Musa program of Gadlut Ha'adam. So Gadlut Ha'adam was really a phrase of Slobodka and of Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, which emphasized the positive greatness of the, in other words, for him, the most important thing for each student was to appreciate what he was good at, what were his good qualities, and develop them and help them grow and practice them and train them and use them for the benefit of Am Yisrael. The whole idea of communal responsibility is something which is often missing in different educational systems. You can educate somebody to be very, let's say, knowledgeable in science, and they can know science to a very high degree, but no one ever told them that they should use their science to the benefit of society. The whole idea of educating people that, right, you've been given a gift of knowledge or of personality, and now go out there and make the world a better place using your energies in order to be a leader, that is something which needs a certain type of education, which Rabbi Yisrael Salanta provided. He added this, he was like the yeast in the dough type of thing of the yeshiva world, to make the young people realize that they had phenomenal Torah knowledge. Go and do something with it. Make a difference. So I've written here, for example, can you see in this little paragraph which starts with the Nosson Tzvi Finkel, that in 1920, he decided to establish a yeshiva in Israel. This was a major, now in 1920, in the Lithuanian yeshiva world, this was a bit of a revolution, right? To send a garin, to send a nucleus of young men to Israel and say, we are going to build a yeshiva in Israel. This was something pretty revolutionary in certain ways, not least because Zionism in that world was associated primarily with secular Zionism, which was the enemy of orthodoxy. In other words, the secular Zionists were seen as people who were tempting the young men and women away from a life of Torah and mitzvahs into a world of Zionist ideology, which wasn't meant to be to complement the Judaism. It was meant to be an alternative to Torah and mitzvahs. That's how it was perceived, secular Zionism, certainly in the 1920s. But Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel saw it differently. He said, no, why leave the land of Israel to the secular Zionists? It's also ours. And therefore, he sent a group of young men. So where did he send them to? He sent them to the town of Hebron, because Hebron is one of the holy places of Israel. And that became known as the Hebron Yeshiva. What is today still the Hebron Yeshiva, which has produced hundreds of rabbonim and educators in the last few generations, right? The Hebron Yeshiva was actually a spin-off of Slabodka, right? And it was a product of Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, who had been inspired by Yisrael Salanter. I'm trying to give you an idea of the continuity of his impact and his influence. So he sent over someone called Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, who was one of his Talmidim, who was became the Rosh Yeshiva of the Hebron Yeshiva. What happened, very sadly, some of you might know your Zionist history, very sadly, 1929. Then 1929 massacre in Hebron, sadly, quite a few of these young men who had come in order to bring Torah from Litta to Israel were killed. Yeah, these were pretty hair-raising times, so to be honest with you. Very, very, very terrible times. And that massacre was really, really awful. But because of that massacre, the Hebron Yeshiva moved to Jerusalem. And to this day, the Hebron Yeshiva is in Jerusalem, but it's called Hebron. But it's interesting to see, if you like, the origins, the genealogy of these institutions. They didn't happen by chance. They didn't come about by themselves. They were created by the force of the personality and the ideology of a small group of dedicated people who were really inspired by Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Yisrael Salanter was a personality of immense charisma combined with immense kedusha. Was a man of tangible kedusha. There was an interesting statement which I've heard attributed to Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, because of course at this time also in Europe was also the time of various new theories were coming about. One of them was Darwin, right? The whole the writings of Darwin were being published at this time, and Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel is famous for saying, he says, I understand why Darwin thought that man had evolved from the apes, because he's never met a real man, but I have met Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And because of that, I know that that theory is not right. So that's an interesting one-liner, which I think says a lot. In other words, they saw in Rabbi Yisrael Salanter a type of human being who was so, on the one hand, so powerful, charismatic, at the same time, ethical and full of kedusha, and Yirat Shamayim and Emunah, that he was able to inspire like a whole range of people who weren't only his students, but people who became leaders. Real leaders create leaders, right? Fake leaders create followers, but real leaders create leaders, right? And that is Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. If you ever want to see somebody who created leaders, just to give you a bit of a taste here, if you have a look, I'm still in this paragraph, which starts with Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel. If you have a look, he says his disciples, the disciples of Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel, include Rabbi Yitzhak Huttner, who was a well-known figure who I still knew and heard and learned from. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, who was also a well-known, one of the Gedolei Yisrael in America in the 20th century. Rabbi Yaakov Ruderman, who established the Nei Yisrael Yeshiva in Baltimore, was also one of the Gedolei Yisrael in America. And Rabbi Aaron Kotler, who built Lakewood, who came. And all these people were inspired by the Alter from Slobodka, Nosson Tzvi Finkel, who told them, look, you have got greatness. Go and use that greatness for the benefit of the Jewish people and build up Am Yisrael, right? So you think about it, if you just put together, this is not an exhaustive list of his Talmidim, you understand? These are just names which I thought that maybe you might have heard of, but all of these people came from the same origins. From their same educational principles, they all had been deeply affected by the Musa movement, which is interesting because the Musa movement is obviously wrongly associated with people who are deeply, if you like, self-critical to the extent of becoming very maybe over modest and overly inhibited and unable to act, right? So one of the aspects of the Musa movement was, as I mentioned here, Gadlut HaAdam, to emphasize for a person what his positive qualities are, his positive traits, and to use them. But if you think for a minute of all the people influenced by Rav Huttner, Rav Kamenetsky, Rav Ruderman, Rav Kotler, you're dealing with hundreds of thousands of people over several generations, right? Who have all drawing their inspiration from Nathan Zvi Finkel, who himself drew it from Yisrael Salanter. So it's a very fascinating to see how the effects of a great leader can have a ripple effect throughout the generations. Then there was someone else called Rav Naftali Amsterdam. Maybe I'll speak more about him some other time. But then Rav Simcha Zisel of Broidy, who was called the Altar of Kelem. So Kelem was a Lithuanian town, not to be confused with Chelm, right? Chelm is the town of idiots, right? Which is the subject of lots of very good Yiddish humor, right? So the people of Chelm tend to be people of greater levels of stupidity. But Kelem, which unfortunately sounds a bit similar, right? He wasn't the altar of Chelm, you understand what I mean? The altar of Chelm were all idiots. The altar of Kelem was in fact another disciple of Yisrael Salanter, also studied in this Kovna Kola of Purushim. The word Purushim is known here in Israel as well. The Talmidei HaGro, when they came to Israel in the early 1800s, they were known as the Purushim. Right, the Purushim was the original Yishuv, 1810, 1820. The Yishuv of the Jewish people of Ashkenazim in Yerushalayim were known as the Purushim. Right, this is a title which has existed among Ashkenaz Jews for a long time. Anyway, Simcha Zisel of Broidy was one of the disciples there of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter in Kovna, and he went on. So again, you can see here his disciples include Rabbi Eliyahu Dessler. Some of you might have seen the Michtav Meliyahu, the writings of Rabbi Dessler, is very well known and published and very worth reading. Rabbi Elia Lopian might be a name that you've heard about as well, the Lev Eliyahu, also one of the great Mashkichim, one of the great teachers of Musa, and Rabbi Yeruchim of Mir. Rabbi Yeruchim of Mir was also had a very profound influence in the Mir Yeshiva in Lithuania and had a deep influence on my teachers. I learned Torah from people like Rabbi Chaim Shmulevitz and Rabbi Shlomo Volber, who were Talmidim of Rabbi Yeruchim of Mir. So there is a sort of a genealogy of Jewish leadership which went through, which was triggered off by Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Before Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the yeshiva world was really, as I said, the heart of Talmudic scholarship, but was not yet really creating leaders, because it wasn't really focusing on personality development. And that was his chiddush. He was interested in people getting involved, getting to know themselves, and to getting to appreciate their own strengths and weaknesses, and developing into people who would make a difference in this world. The last one I've mentioned here is Rabbi Yosef Horovitz, who was known as the Altar of Navardok. Right. Again, maybe more of him later on. But I see there's a printing mistake in the last line on your sheet. It means the Gateshead Yeshiva, not the Gera. I misspelled it. The Gateshead Yeshiva in the UK is called Yeshivas Beis Yosef after Rabbi Yosef Horovitz of Navarodok. So they consider themselves to be a continuation of that of the Musa movement as well. Why have I brought you all this? That you shouldn't think that the Musa movement, Yisrael Salanter, was like some sort of little curiosity in the Jewish world in the 19th century. It wasn't. It was really a force which transformed the whole of the non-Hasidic world totally. It changed the way they thought, the way they learned, the way they developed, and their goals and their personalities were all deeply affected by Rabbi Yisrael Salanter and his teachings. And in that sense, you know, he was somebody who whose contribution to the Jewish people is in many ways inestimable. One of the other interesting aspects of Yisrael Salanter, let's now focus on something else for a moment, not on his disciples, but on the nature of his teachings. He was actually very interested, as I said before, in personality development. And because of that, he was interested in what we would call today psychology. Now, psychology today is a major part of the Western world, but in the 19th century, it was just beginning. In fact, Yisrael Salanter was a contemporary of Sigmund Freud, right? Sigmund Freud was only born in 1856, right? So, and just to remind you, Yisrael Salanter's life was from 1810 till 1883. So really in the last 30 years of Yisrael Salanter's life, Sigmund Freud's writings and teachings were beginning to have an influence on the way people were thinking. And the idea of being a psychologist, right, and getting involved in the study of psychology, and psychology as an area as a discipline and as a study, was a big innovation of the 19th century. Before that, no one had ever heard of studying psychology. There was no such topic. No one's ever heard of it, right? But it was introduced in the 19th century that a study of the human psyche, study of how human beings think, how they develop, and what motivates people to do what they do, became something interesting. And Yisrael Salanter understood that this new field of psychology could be a wonderful tool also in the teaching of Torah. So he wanted his students to become more psychologically aware, more psychologically developed. And primarily what this meant was that he wrote a fair amount. Again, Yisrael Salanter himself never wrote a book in his life. He didn't write a book of his beliefs and ideas, but he spoke, he gave lots of public lectures, which were all written down. And he wrote articles in various journals, and he wrote letters to his Talmidim. So it was Rabbi Yitzchok Blaser who collected all that and edited it and put it into a book called Ori Yisrael, which is not an easy book to read. It's got 31 letters that he wrote in his life to various different students of his. And each one of them contains fascinating insights. But one of the recurring themes is that he picked out from Freud this idea that we have to realize that we have both conscious motives and subconscious motives. The idea of the subconscious, the idea that we are sometimes driven by motives which we're not fully aware of. Right? And that the subconscious motives are often connected to our own ego or to our own anxieties, various different types of subconscious motives, which make us do things which consciously we're not really, unless we focus on it and analyze it, we're not really aware of why we're doing what we're doing. Right? And this idea, he says, is a very useful tool in personality development and in character development, right? He didn't, of course, accept Freudian analysis of this, which is completely all about deeper sexual conflicts of one sort or another, but he did accept the idea that within everybody's mind, there what he used to use refers to the word of negiot. Negiot means personal interests that you might have, which you're not so aware of, which cause you to do things that you do it for motives that you're not so aware of. So he encouraged people to become more self-aware. One of the interesting things that was very much part of his system of education was that a person had to identify if he had, if you like, a personality flaw of some sort. Let's say somebody was able to identify that he had a personality flaw, that he was he easily got angry. He had a tendency to anger, or he had a tendency to laziness. Right, the two of the big themes that he often spoke about, which he picked out actually from the Mesillas Yesharim. Right, Mesillas Yesharim speaks about these issues. So Mesillas Yesharim says it's a natural human. It's a natural human feature of what he called of atzlos. Atzlos we could translate as apathy or inertia or laziness of one sort or another. So if you feel that you have so Charles Salanter's educational system was such, if a person felt about himself that he had a problem with laziness, he had to, two things. First of all, he had to accept upon himself a new sort of anti-laziness sort of commitment, right? So if you felt that you were lazy, you had to, for example, accept upon yourself for the next 30 days, you're going to get up an hour earlier than everybody else in order to train yourself out of laziness, right? But that's only half the story. The other half of the story is you have to keep a journal, a daily journal. How well are you doing? Today, I managed to do this. And this happened and that happened. And then you look back on it over the month and you can decide, are you making any progress or not? So he had a very systematic approach to identifying shortcomings and also identifying personal strengths. It wasn't only negative, it was also positive, right? But the idea of a Musa journal became something which was very well used and is still used in certain circles by people who take the whole Musa philosophy seriously. But it is a way of what has come to, I mean, nowadays in the non-Jewish world, there are all sorts of self-help books, right? How to make yourself more this or more that or more the other, you know, how to be more assertive, and all of it requires a certain amount of self-training, of being aware that if you feel you're not assertive enough, you're too shy, right? So there are dozens of books out there, train yourself to be more assertive. How do you do it? Exercises, keeping a journal, how are you succeeding? So today, this is not unusual. In the 19th century, this was unheard of, really, to do this as part of an educational system. And you understand that all this is going on at the same time as learning Shas. He's addressing people who are spending their whole day from morning till evening in the Beis HaMedrash, learning Gemara and the Rambam and Rishonim and Achronim and Reb Chaim Briska and all the Londas of the Gemara, but at the same time he says you mustn't ignore the personality, right? So Musa was a way of focusing away from the text of the Torah. What was the topic of Musa? The topic of Musa was you. In other words, where are you at? What do you have to modify, what are your strengths and what are your weaknesses? And this was a major new approach to the Musa, to Jewish education. Again, coming back to the point I started with at the beginning of the Shia, I think one of the reasons why Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was not interested in the more mystical, Kabbalistic terminology and ideas is because he felt that the words and the ideas used in the more mystical and Hasidic texts were not helpful for people to grow and develop their personalities. So, for example, in terms of the Yetzer Hara, right, a person's tendency to do bad things. So the Musa, the Kabbalistic world spoke about of the Koach HaKadusha and the Koach HaTuma. But actually the internal struggle of the human being is because in him he's got the power that wants to attain sanctity, Kadusha, and the power that is drawn by Tuma. Now, the ideas of Kedusha and Tumah he felt were not helpful in Jewish education. But actually, in education, Kedusha and Tumah is something which we can't grasp completely. Better to speak about the way in which a person's... So for him, the Yetzer Hara, and again, he got this a little bit from psychology and Freudian literature, the Yetzer Hara was what we would call today ego. Right? Now, ego is an important thing. Everybody understands that if you haven't got an ego, if you haven't got a strength of ego, you can't achieve anything in life, right? Ego is useful, right? In order to be able to build a building, to raise a family, to assert yourself, to write a book, to be a leader, you have to have a certain amount of ego. The question is, are you using the ego creatively or are you using it destructively, right? So this became a much more sophisticated analysis. Rather than speaking about Kedusha and Tumah, you spoke about the ego of the person, which in some way is the Yetzer Hara, Now, this is actually, it might be worth mentioning. Chazal used this phrase, Yetzer Hara, which everybody has heard at one point or another. And the Yetzer Hara is generally understood to be, as translated in English, the evil inclination. Okay, now, do we have an inclination to do evil? The word evil actually sounds in English pretty demonic. Most people, I think, would feel that we're not driven to do anything evil in our life, right? And therefore, this translation is just not helpful. You don't understand what the... So the Yetzer Hara, right, in some way, it needs to be understood much more on a subtle basis. And indeed, the Yetzer Hara for Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was the ego, which if you get obsessed with your ego, you get into an excessive amount of gaiva, of arrogance and pride is all about ego. Taiva, the pursuit of self-indulgence and self-gratification is all about ego, right? The over-pursuit of wealth and power is covered, is all about ego. But that's when ego gets out of hand. But really, the ego is something you can't repress the ego, because then you're just simply an ineffective, depressed individual. The ego needs to be functioning well, but it needs to be directed towards positive things. So this is a very, very interesting a subtlety in his teachings. So for example, Chazal speak about anova at great length, anova being humility. So if someone gets up and teaches a class of students about the importance of developing humility, it's wonderful in the sense they won't become arrogant, but it's got a tremendous danger to it. The danger is it all becomes so humble that they'll do nothing with their life. They won't do anything. Because don't forget, young people are just a little bit beginning to develop their own self-esteem, right? And if you speak too much about humility, you can crush self-esteem. So the balance between humility on the one hand and self-esteem and confidence and ambition, all these things have to be at the same time as humility. How do you get that balance right? So that's what Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was interested in. And indeed, I had a mashgiach. I remember very clearly the first yeshiva I went to after high school. I was just a London Hasmonean boy. Those people who know a bit about London might know what that means. And I arrived in Israel at a tender age of 17 and came to the yeshiva, thank you very much, the yeshiva of Kol Torah here in Israel. And Kol Torah is a classic literature yeshiva. The Rosh Yeshiva was of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who I only got to know a bit later on. But the first person who made an enormous impact on me was the Mashkiach. And the Mashkiach was someone called Rav Gedalia Eisenman, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who considered himself to be a disciple of the Altar of Kelem. He came from the Simcha Zisla Broidy's Musa school and her Musa tradition. And he was the Mashkiach. And he used to give talks in Kol Torah. Musa, weekly Musa talk, sometimes twice a week, and they were very fascinating. And I remember very clearly that one of his talks early on, I was still trying to learn Hebrew, you understand? Everything in Kol Torah is all in Hebrew. So the Shlomo Zalman only gave Shurim in Hebrew, and Rabbi Gedalia Eisenman only gave Shurim in Hebrew. I'd learned modern Hebrew in high school, but I didn't yet have a fluency in it. But wanting to hear these Shurim was my main incentive. To learning Ivrit at the time. And it's, within 6 months, I'd mastered certainly enough Ivrit to understand the Shiurim. And I remember very clearly one of the first Shiurim I understood was when he gave a talk about the value of modesty as opposed to arrogance, anova. And half of the Shiur was about the importance of self-esteem, of recognizing your strengths and recognizing what you're good at. And the whole talk was a very beautiful, finely tuned balance between not being arrogant on the one hand, but being confident. What's the dividing line between being arrogant and being confident? Who knows the answer to that question, right? The answer is, if it's me, I'm confident. If it's you, you're arrogant. That's usually how people understand the difference between being confident and arrogant. You understand what I mean? That if it's somebody you like, then that's confidence. If somebody you don't like, then he's arrogant. So we use these words interchangeably, but really there's some very important differences here. Right? If you're using your strengths creatively to help people and to better and in some way contribute to the world and to society. That's confidence. That's terrific. The minute you do just on an ego trip, then that's arrogance. But the distinction there was something that Rishal Salanter really, the whole issue, it was something that he introduced into the yeshiva world, educational system. And all these people that you mentioned, that you see here, Rav Dester, Rav Lopian, and Rav Yeruchim, and Rav Hutton, Rav Kamenetsky, they were all teaching this Torah. This Torah was an integral part of everything that they taught. Yes, we have to be worried about arrogance, but no, we don't want to become overly humble to the extent that we can't achieve things in this world. We have to, great leaders create leaders. And that was what they were interested in. And that was really part of the innovation of Yisrael Salanter. There's also one other yeshiva that I haven't mentioned here on the sheet, was the Telz yeshiva. Telz yeshiva was an important yeshiva in Lithuania. I don't know if you've heard of the Telz yeshiva. The big Telz yeshiva today is in Cleveland, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right, in Cleveland? The Telz yeshiva in Cleveland. Here in Israel, the Telz Yeshiva is in Telstone. Right? Somebody might have heard of Telstone, just outside Yerushalayim here. They got a whole hilltop and built a whole shchuna, and that's Telstone. But the Telz Yeshiva was established by someone called Rabbi Eliezer Gordon. Rabbi Eliezer Gordon was the Rosh Yeshiva there, and he was also a Talmud of Yisrael Salanter. And he understood that this yeshiva needed, in addition to having a 90% Talmud curriculum, it needed a 10% Musa curriculum. And he introduced Musa into the Telz Yeshiva. He brought in someone called Rableib Chassman, who later on wrote beautiful ideas. But the Telz Yeshiva was also another part of this a very interesting jigsaw, which created the Lithuanian yeshiva world as we know it today. The last 25 years of Yisrael Salanter's life, he did something extraordinary, which maybe if I find some more material on this, it's surprisingly not well documented. But he left Kovno in 1857 and he went to France, which was Western Europe, and it was a highly assimilated society. And then he went to Germany. And in fact, he died eventually in Germany and buried in Königsberg. And in the last 25 years of his life, he was engaged also, you can see what an innovator he was, having set up a whole team of leaders who would change the whole yeshiva world. He engaged in what we would call today Kiruv Rechokim. Now, Kiruv was not known at that time as if you like, certainly not a profession, but not even something which could possibly work. There were people, of course, in Western Europe, I would say the vast majority of Jews in Germany, France, England, and Holland had been swept away by the Enlightenment and modernity and Reform Judaism and assimilation and had abandoned Torah and mitzvahs completely. The numbers are frightening. Be honest with you, the numbers are absolutely frightening. In the Western Europe, the impact of the reform and generally of assimilation was absolutely devastating for Judaism, right? He knew this. So he was living in the Eastern Europe, which where there was also an impact of the Haskalah and of the modernity, but not to such a great extent. And he decided he's personally going to go to France and Germany, and he's going to teach Jewish students about Judaism. And he did that for the last 25 years of his life, right? And there are some very interesting reports of how he would get together and how he would have an impact on some individuals, but we don't know much about it. But I'm just impressed by the fact that he did that, that he was interested. He felt it's no good sitting in Kovno, surrounded by Talmidei Chachamim, when half of the European Jewish world is drowning in assimilation. I can't do that, right? So he went out there in order to single-handedly try and at least put out a message of some sort there. I'm going to still try and get some documentation and some details about who he met and what he did, etc. It's surprisingly not a well-known part of his life. But that was the last 25 years of his life. It wasn't just the odd weekend, you understand? He dedicated the last portion of his life to this, and I'm sure he was very effective to the people that he met. But at the end of the day, he was a very specialized individual. He didn't in order to be successful in that sort of environment, one needs to have a certain element of populism or popularity, right? La Havdil, if you compare it, for example, to somebody who you've all heard of, Shlomo Carlebach. Okay, so Shlomo Carlebach was a top yeshiva bacha in Lakewood Yeshiva, completely involved only in learning and teaching Gemara, and he was one of the stars of Rav Kotler in the 1950s, right? And there came the 60s, and he realized that in the 60s, hundreds of thousands of Jewish young men and women were being swept away by modernity and by the whole new worldview in the 60s and the 70s, and were getting lost to Judaism. And he left the yeshiva, took his guitar, and he went on campus. And why did he do this? Why? So he was questioned lots of times by his colleagues. Don't forget, he had grown up in the Lithuanian yeshiva world, and all his colleagues were Talmidei Chachamim, were people who were classic yeshivish people. And what he was doing was at the very least, it was hair-raising, but it was more than that. It was almost heretical. What are you doing going out there? There are women there as well, and they're not dressed properly, and you're on campus, and you're going into the world of tumah and of assimilation and modernity. You know, we're in yeshiva, we've got to protect ourselves. And he used to say, I heard him myself, I met him a couple of times, I heard him myself, he used to say, Al ta'amod al dam re'ach. You can't stand by and watch people drowning and do nothing. And this is true not only physically, but also spiritually. I can't sit in the yeshiva and learn Gemara knowing that millions of young men and women are drowning in the world of modernity and not even ever getting a taste of Judaism and Jewish life. They're never even going to hear a Jewish niggun of any sort. They're never going to hear a Jewish story. They're going to hear nothing. How can we do that, right? So he said, I'm involved in pikuach nefesh. I'm involved in trying to save the few people that I could save. So, to the best of my knowledge, Mr. Solanter did not have a guitar, you understand. And he wasn't, he didn't have music, and he didn't have a popular way of reaching the students in France and in Germany in the late 1900s, the late 1800s, late 19th century. But he was actually, in a funny sort of way, he was motivated with the same motives as Rav Shlomo Carlebach had. Rav Shlomo Carlebach had the ability to reach people who everybody else thought was completely unreachable. And he just did it through music and love, unconditional. He loved everybody. He hugged everybody, men and women equally. He hugged everybody. He loved everybody. And he was completely a phenomenon. Shlomo Carlebach was a complete, amazing phenomenon. And in the yeshiva world, he was considered to be, if you like, a heretic in a certain sense. He had abandoned the yeshiva world, but actually people who have a bit of a broader perspective realize that he actually, thousands of people today lead a Torah life of mitzvahs because of him. He was able, what do you say?
And sing,
yes. There's never been, I want to tell you all of you, there's never been a chasna or a yomim neroim that any of you have been at, which hasn't included Shlomo Carlebach singing. There's never been. Every single one of you have heard thousands of his songs. And I'll tell you something interesting about his songs, something which his family were very angry with him about for his whole life. He refused to copyright his music. He never earned a penny from copyrighting his music. He said, my music belongs to Am Yisrael. And because of which he died a poor man. He actually died a poor man. And had he copyrighted his music, he would have been phenomenally wealthy. But he said, my music is not mine. It's not mine. It belongs to the Jewish people. So you can see we're dealing with people who've got ideals, who are motivated in very beautiful ways. I've always been impressed by this, you know, and he, when he put together a community center, there were several Karlbach community centers around the world. What were they called? Anybody know what they were called? They were called the House of Love and Prayer. His houses of love and prayer. That's what they were called. He had some in Los Angeles, he had some in Israel, he had some in Europe, the House of Love and Prayer. And that's what they practiced. They practiced love and prayer. And why do I mention Shlomo Karlbach? Because in a funny sort of way, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was attempting to do something similar in the last 25 years of his life, to reach people that no one else was reaching and trying to get to them the message of Torah and mitzvahs. As I say, so he tried his best. I'm not sure how successful he was, but that was all we have time for today. And just give you a taste of the impact of a single charismatic, dedicated leader to change the Jewish world. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much.